Hello and welcome to Religion in the News. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and today we'll be featuring articles from the St. Paul Pioneer Press, from the Washington Post, from Religion News Service, and more. Today's program is generously supported by White Memorial Presbyterian Church. They can be reached at 919-834-3424, and we thank them for their contribution. The contents of this program are intended for people who are blind and print impaired. We begin this week's episode of Religion in the News with an article from the St. Paul Pioneer Press in Minnesota, dated January 18th. The headline of this article, Cottage Grove Church to Usher Out Gray-Haired Members in Effort to Attract More Young Parishioners. This article is by Bob Shaw of the Pioneer Press, and it's dateline Cottage Grove, Minnesota. A prayer for survival rose from the back of the church last Sunday. "I pray for this church, getting through this age discrimination thing," said William Gackstetter, as the gray-haired heads around him nodded in agreement. Gackstetter and other members of the Grove United Methodist Church in Cottage Grove are upset enough that their church is closing in June. What makes it worse is that their church is reopening in November, pretty much without them. The church wants to attract more young families. The present members, most of them over 60 years old, will be invited to worship somewhere else. A memo recommends that they stay away for 2 years, then consult the pastor about attending the Cottage Grove location again. Officials say the church needs a reset, and reopening the church is the best way to appeal to younger people. But the older church members say they see that as an insult. "This is totally wrong," said Gackstetter's wife, Cheryl. "They are discriminating against us because of our age." After the plan was explained by a pastor on January 5th, she said, "I called him a hypocrite. I said, 'You are kicking us out of our church.'" 30 years ago, the Peaceful Grove Church was founded by Pastor Jim Baker in an elementary school. It moved into its own building, then merged with a larger church in Woodbury in 2008. Today, the churches are the Woodbury and Cottage Grove branches of the Grove United Methodist Church. The Cottage Grove Church struggled with membership and finances. 7 years ago, Methodist officials said they could no longer pay for a minister for the church. That's when the Cottage Grove Church switched to lay ministry, with weekly sermons by members of the church. The decision was made by two leadership teams within the two church organization. "This created a lot of independence. We kept it going," said church founder Baker. "That's why the members are so fiercely loyal," he said. Recently, the church's attendance and finances have stabilized, with an average of 25 people worshiping weekly. But stabilizing isn't good enough. Cottage Grove is growing quickly, and the church should be growing, said the Reverend Dan Wetterstrom, head of the two-location Grove Church. "We've not figured out how to reach new people there," he said. "Cottage Grove is underserved by churches," he said. "The benchmark is one church for every 1,000 residents, so 37,000 population Cottage Grove might be expected to have 37 churches. In fact, it has only 13. In a memo summarizing a December 12th meeting, Wetterstrom said the church could soon die, saying, "Unless something changes, we are nearing the end." The answer is a new appeal to younger families. "Jesus said we are called to reach new people," said Wetterstrom. He said that Methodist's regional annual conference is paying $250,000 to restart the church. They've hired a specialist in starting new churches, Jeremy Peters. Peters, age 32, has moved to Cottage Grove with his wife and three children. He's working with community groups, laying the groundwork for the relaunch, probably in November. "It's a new thing with a new mission for a new target," said Peters, "and a new culture." The older members will not be physically barred from attending, but the expectation is that they will not. "We're asking them to let this happen," said Wetterstrom. "For this to be truly new, we can't have the core group of 30 people. The members of the church have other options. They can come to Woodbury during this phase." How long should they stay away? Wetterstrom's timetable for the transition explains. 15 to 18 months after weekly worship is launched at Cottage Grove campus, those members of the current campus who are interested in migrating back connect with Peters about how to best make that transition. Church leadership has suggested the present-day members could be welcome if they supported the youthful new identity of the church. If they are on board with that, they are all welcome to attend and engage, said Peters. The plan was communicated to all church members. But not all of those members feel welcome. The past few weeks have seen confusion, anxiety, and anger, said member Ron Purcell as he opened the January 12th service. The 35 people in the pews listened, their faces grim. The service continued with a 6-year-old recorded sermon and a puppet show by church founder Baker. Afterward, William Gackstetter said the aging membership has been asked to continue maintaining the church until it reopens without them. They want us to mow the lawn and shovel the snow, he said, as if anyone would do that. This whole plan makes me sick. I believe it's evil. Cheryl Gackstetter added, we are supposed to be silent partners. She admitted that the membership was not exactly youthful. We are mostly 60 and up, she said. They don't want to go where they are not wanted, she said. They want to create renewal, said church founder Baker. I am all for renewal, but why not do it with everyone? It doesn't make a lot of sense. He questioned the wisdom of trying to reopen the church in the same building and with the same name, with the pews full of vibrant young families. In other words, people like the Knapps. Stella and John Knapp of Cottage Grove were the only members with children at the service, and they say they hate the plan. If it happened, I wouldn't come here anymore, said Stella, age 34. As 6-year members, the couple loves the church and do not see how any Methodist miracle can draw in more people like them. But did it bother them to be the youngest members at the Sunday service? Not at all, said John, age 34. This church is very kind to us and our children. Our next article this week comes from the Associated Press, and it was dated January 23rd. And the headline, Islamic Leaders Make Groundbreaking Visit to Auschwitz. And this is by Vanessa Guerra of the AP, Dateline, Warsaw, Poland. Muslim religious leaders joined members of a U.S. Jewish group at Auschwitz on Thursday for what organizers described as the most senior Islamic leadership delegation to visit the site of a Nazi German death camp. The interfaith visit came 4 days before the 75th anniversary of the camp's January 27, 1945 liberation by Soviet forces, and as world leaders gathered in Jerusalem to commemorate the Holocaust. The Secretary General of the Muslim World League, Mohammed bin Abdul Karim al-Issa, and the CEO of the American Jewish Committee, David Harris, led the tour to the Auschwitz-Birkenau Memorial in Poland. The Nazis operated extermination and concentration camps in Poland when Germany occupied the country during World War II. The American Jewish Committee said that al-Issa, who is based in Mecca, Saudi Arabia, led a delegation of 62 Muslims, including 25 prominent religious leaders from some 28 countries during the groundbreaking visit. At one point, they prayed with their heads pressed on the ground at Birkenau, the largest part of the camp and the most notorious site of Germany's mass murder of European Jews. The AJC delegation included members of the organization, among them children of Holocaust survivors. To be here among the children of Holocaust survivors and members of the Jewish and Islamic communities is both a sacred duty and a profound honor, al-Issa said. The unconscionable crimes to which we bear witness today are truly crimes against humanity. That is to say, a violation of us all, an affront to all of God's children. Auschwitz was the most notorious in a system of death and concentration camps that Nazi Germany operated on territory it occupied across Europe. In all, 1.1 million people were killed there, most of them Jews from across the continent. The visit comes as Saudi Arabia works to be seen abroad as a moderate and modernizing country following decades of adherence to a hardline interpretation of Islam known as Wahhabism. The Muslim World League, under al-Issa's leadership, has embraced the effort. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's strategy to modernize the kingdom is aimed in part at attracting greater foreign investment and fostering a national Saudi identity that is not founded solely on conservative religious values. Al-Issa's outreach to Jewish organizations also coincides with a broader alignment of interests and ties emerging between the Arab Gulf states and Israel, which share a common foe in Iran. On Friday, members of the delegation will visit the Poland Museum of the History of Polish Jews in Warsaw and attend Muslim and Jewish religious services there. We'll continue on Religion in the News by finishing up an article that we began last week, and this is from the Washington Post magazine dated January 6th, and the title of this article is The Evangelist, and it's a profile of an evangelical progressive preacher named Shane Claiborne. And where we stopped last week, the preacher was in Cleveland preaching to a congregation discussing the shooting death of Tamir Rice by the Cleveland Police Department. And you'll hear in the article that we'll read, you'll hear only last names referenced. When you hear Goldsby, she is the cousin of Tamir Rice and a co-founder of Cleveland's Black Lives Matter chapter. And Claiborne is Shane Claiborne, who's the preacher that's being profiled in this piece. So we'll pick up where we left off last week. The first two speakers that followed talked about family members being killed on Cleveland streets. The third, a bearded middle-aged man who went by the name Tank, said he'd been shot 11 times and had spent most of his adult life in prison. He had been out for 10 years. Goldsby went last. She put a palm on the table before her, waiting for the applause to die down. Many white evangelicals see Black Lives Matter as divisive and unduly hostile. Evangelist Franklin Graham, for one, has attacked it for calling for violence against police and has claimed most police shootings can be avoided with a combination of respect for authority and obedience. Goldsby began by asking the crowd to say the names of loved ones who had died because of gun violence. "I want you to bring their name into the space," she said. "It's important to remember their names." After the murmurs died down, she recounted the death of her cousin, how the officer shot him in a park in 2014, how he died from his wounds the next day. She said it fit a pattern she had experienced for years, one that had also claimed the lives of her children's friends. And yes, police brutality, police violence is gun violence. All across the crowd, people were nodding in assent. "We are the community. We need to act like the community. I don't want to see my sisters, my brothers hurting because they lost their child to gun violence when it can be prevented, when we can execute the change we want to see." We made our way outdoors where Martin was waiting. "The gun barrel of the AR-15 that was donated tonight is inside," he said, gesturing toward a black metal box propped on a table. He invited anyone who wanted to come take a swing. A woman in a crimson pantsuit approached and took the goggles Martin handed her. He reached into a forge with tongs and pulled out the barrel, which glowed as bright as the fire. The woman raised Martin's hammer in silence and struck the metal half a dozen times. The crowd began applauding. She kept going, now putting her back into it, bringing the hammer down with all her might. After a few dozen hits, the applause started again, building to a crescendo as she backed away and let her shoulders sag. Goldsby took her turn a few minutes later. She hit the glowing metal again and again. Everyone within a 15-foot radius could feel her anger. The furnace made a rustling sound behind her. When she was done, another 7 or 8 people took up the hammer in succession. Finally, a pastor with Claiborne's group on the tour led everyone back inside to the refrain of "If I Had a Hammer." Claiborne took the mic again for the conclusion. He wanted the crowd to remember that the "beat their swords into plowshares" verse from Isaiah is a prophecy of world peace, a promise that one day nation will not rise up in violence against nation. Destroying the weapons was the first step. "I like that because the peace, according to the prophets, doesn't begin with the politicians," he said. "It begins with the people who lead the politicians toward that peace." For anyone Claiborne's age or younger, the alliance of the evangelical establishment and the GOP has always been a given. But the origins of the Christian right as we know it only date back to the presidency of Jimmy Carter, himself a Democrat who was also a devout Southern Baptist. It was in those years that Jerry Falwell Sr. ramped up his preaching across the South, working to convince evangelicals of various stripes, fundamentalists, Pentecostals, and conservative Southern Baptists, as the journalist and historian Frances Fitzgerald wrote in her 2017 book, The Evangelicals, that they and others could work for common goals without compromising their theology or even making a formal alliance. In the early days, Falwell focused on so-called social issues, abortion, homosexuality, and Christian prayer in schools, to name a few. Over the following decade, televangelists like Pat Robertson and Jim Baker helped carry Falwell's message beyond the South. And in 1988, Robertson founded the Christian Coalition, a nonprofit meant to mobilize evangelicals to vote for Republican candidates. It wasn't until 1995, after the Republicans had swept the midterm elections, propelled by the release of Newt Gingrich's conservative legislative blueprint, Contract with America, that Ralph Reed, the Christian Coalition's director, could say his movement was thoroughly integrated and enmeshed into the machinery of the Republican Party. In the short term, this partnership was a boon for both the GOP and the conservative faith leaders. But it had an unintended consequence. People who came of age in the 90s or later learned to see the GOP and evangelicalism, or even religion more broadly, as almost synonymous. Rejecting one would reject the other. During the 90s, in the aftermath of Bill Clinton's affair with Monica Lewinsky, leaders of the Christian right harped for several years on the importance of character. You can't run a family, let alone a country, without it, Focus on the Family director James Dobson told his supporters in 1998. How foolish to believe that a person who lacks honesty and moral integrity is qualified to lead a nation and the world. So as the 2016 race got underway, it seemed early on like Trump's lifelong pattern of brazen infidelity and charges of sexual harassment were bound to be stumbling blocks. During an interview before an evangelical audience in 2015, Trump said he generally does not ask God for forgiveness. However, instead of trying to fake his moral credentials, the candidate made an appeal to white evangelicals that was bluntly transactional. If elected, he promised, he would appoint avowedly anti-abortion federal judges, restore the religious freedoms that Obama had supposedly taken away, and move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. The strategy worked astonishingly well. Mega church leaders gave him their endorsements en masse, and apparently without much hesitation. And as the election neared, white evangelicals proved to be one of Trump's most loyal demographics. In November 2016, some 81% cast ballots in his favor. Since the early days of the Christian right, there has been a parallel Christian left, and it has surged during Republican administrations. During Ronald Reagan's presidency, for instance, liberal churches created the sanctuary movement, giving shelter to refugees from El Salvador and Guatemala, countries where the United States was backing illiberal regimes. And in the early 2000s, Christians turned out in massive numbers to protest the Iraq War and the Bush administration's defense of torture. But as a percentage, the number of young people who have crossed over to this camp, instead of defecting from Christian institutions altogether, has never been large. In the mid-2000s, there was a lot of talk about younger evangelicals who are going to be rallying around climate change, who are going to rally around LGBT rights, says Robert P. Jones, the director of the Public Religion Research Institute. And that never really materialized. I think what really happened was the younger evangelicals who might have held these views, instead of staying evangelical and shifting the needle within evangelicalism, most of them just left the category and became unaffiliated. David Campbell, a political scientist at the University of Notre Dame, agrees that there has been a backlash and says it's been intensified since the rise of Trump. Increasingly, people are putting their politics ahead of their religion, he says. That is, they're willing to shift their religious identity to the point of dropping a religious identity because they see religion as wrapped in conservative politics. Among the scholars I spoke with, one common refrain was that political engagement itself is not the problem. Partisanship is. What is important is that any religious group not be closely tied to a party, Campbell says, because as soon as that happens, then the religious voice ceases to be prophetic and is only viewed as being partisan. Claiborne hews closely to this nonpartisan approach, though he does vote, typically for Democrats. Research shows that among all those millennials who say they're religiously unaffiliated, only about half call themselves atheists or agnostics. There's often a sense of, oh, they're waking up on Sunday and rejecting church, says Angie Thurston, a fellow at Harvard Divinity School who studies the spiritual lives of young Americans. The reality is they don't even think about it. It's not an act of rejection. It's just like, this doesn't feel relevant to my life. At the same time, she says, they often have a very active keening for many experiences we might call spiritual or even religious. So what would make it feel relevant? Thurston's research points to 7 experiences young people are looking for in spiritual settings, including creativity, community, and social transformation. In other words, experiences that Claiborne is skilled at curating. Shane and Katie Joe live across the street from the original Simple Way building, which now houses the organization's offices and food pantry. After 22 years, Claiborne is the only member of the original group who still lives in the neighborhood. But the Simple Way's footprint is larger than ever, with an affordable housing program, one of the largest food pantries in Philadelphia, and a full tuition scholarship fund that sends a neighborhood kid to Eastern University every year. During a visit over the summer, 2 months after the tour, Claiborne drove me to St. Edward the Confessor, the abandoned Catholic church where Claiborne's activist career was launched. Claiborne tells the story memorably in The Irresistible Revolution. When he was a college junior, some homeless women moved into the building with their kids, trying to duck social workers. Claiborne and his friends read about it in their school cafeteria. The front page of the Philadelphia Inquirer said the archdiocese would be evicting the families the next day. That night, the students posted flyers around campus saying, "Jesus is getting kicked out of church in North Philly. Come hear about it. Key Lounge, 10 p.m. tonight." They expected no more than a dozen friends to come, but more than 100 students showed up. The next morning, they were there before the reporters and TV cameras arrived. They announced that they would stand in the way even if it meant getting arrested, something Claiborne had never experienced. "It made for quite a media spectacle," he wrote in his memoir. Later that day, when representatives from the archdiocese came, they stepped out of their car, saw the crowd, and turned around to leave. Over the weeks that followed, authorities tried repeatedly to evict the families while the students were away. Whenever Claiborne's group got a call, they rallied the campus with an air horn, leading a caravan to the church as fast as they could. And on Sundays, they held worship services there, ringing the church bell and bringing in a gospel choir. They staved off an eviction until the families were ready to leave of their own accord, some to the homes of volunteers offering to host them, others to vacant government-owned homes, though the archdiocese in Claiborne's telling never did anything to help. The building itself, one of the great architectural treasures of Philadelphia, is now abandoned and decrepit. On our visit, Claiborne parked down the block, and we walked to the front. In the entrance, beneath a stone statue of Christ inlaid into the arch, the doors have "no trespassing" signs and spray paint graffiti. Claiborne pointed to the spot where the homeless mothers had once held a news conference. They said, "We mean no disrespect to the church officials, but we talked to the real owner of the building, you know, the Lord," he chuckled, "and God said we could stay." It was brilliant. It was so brilliant. He's daydreamed about having the Simple Way by the building, but the logistics don't make sense. Still, it remains a source of inspiration. In his work as a public figure, he's trying to give other people something like the experience he had there as a 20-year-old. When you know people who have been victims of injustices, it puts a real fire in your bones, a real sense of urgency, he said as we were leaving. It's the reason he shares the stage with people like LaTanya Goldsby, the reason he tells so many stories about his neighborhood in Philly. "I think relationships do it most poignantly," he said, "but stories get us one step closer in proximity." We'll wrap up this week's edition of Religion in the News with some more predictions on the next decade of religion that were published earlier this year in Religion News Service. We've been featuring these intermittently for the first portion of this year, and we'll wrap it up here in the next couple of weeks. And this is a series of interviews that was conducted by Aisha Khan of Religion News Service with various faith leaders from across the country and various denominations and traditions from the Christianity side to the Muslim side to the Jewish side and everything in between. And so we'll continue and begin this portion with the prediction of the Reverend Tom Reese, who's a senior analyst at RNS, a Jesuit priest who writes the Signs of the Times column. His prediction: Pope Francis shifts church priorities. The election of Pope Francis and his impact on the Catholic Church is the most important news story for Catholics. He has refocused its pastoral priorities away from legalism to compassion and mercy. He has focused the public priorities of the Church on refugees, the poor, and global warming. In the U.S., the sex abuse crisis in the Catholic Church has moved from protection of minors, which has been fairly successful, to holding bishops accountable for covering up abuse. The abuse crisis has also expanded to other faith traditions. For the country as a whole, the major shift has been the continuing growth of nuns as a percentage of the population. Politically, the continued support of Trump by white evangelicals is critical. Internationally, the big stories have been the rise of Hindu nationalism in India, the rise and fall of ISIS, genocide against Rohingya in Myanmar, and the persecution of Uyghurs in China. In the next decade, we will see more believers committed to protecting the planet and slowing global warming. More interreligious cooperation will take place at the same time that interreligious conflicts increase. Catholics will elect a new pope. From Dalia Mogahed, who is Director of Research at the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding and researches the thought leadership programs on American Muslims, religion keeps going digital. Muslim young people are as likely as their elders to say religion is important, unlike their generational peers in the general public, but they are less likely to participate in communal prayer. Religion has resonance among young Muslims, but has become hyper-individualized. Instead of going to a lecture at a mosque, young people join via Facebook Live. Instead of going to Jama'ah prayers every Friday, people are engaging their faith through YouTube videos or lectures from their favorite speaker. This digitization to religious engagement both gives more access and risks fragmentation, polarization, and the loss of shared understanding, experience, and solidarity. There is a related but distinct trend of the drift of practicing Muslims to both the left and to the right. This shows up as the paradigms and language of progressive social movements in the case of the left, and the alt-right in the case of the right. They are superimposed on religious narratives rather than starting with God's guidance to form moral positions. And this is from Charles Camasi, who writes the Purple Catholicism column at RNS and is an associate professor of theological and social ethics at Fordham University, in defense of human dignity. In Roman Catholicism, lots of folks are going to speak about the election and pontificate of Pope Francis, and that indeed has been a major shift and event. But maybe an even bigger shift was the event that prompted his election, the 2013 resignation of Pope Benedict, the first time a pope has resigned by his own decision since 1294. It was the first shift in a major rethinking of the papacy itself, which Pope Francis continued, albeit in a different way. Over the next decade, I think the major theme in Catholicism and religions that focus on human dignity will be to try to come to the defense of human dignity in relation to four major threats: artificial intelligence and robotics, including sex robots and robot soldiers; automated jobs, including truck driving and similar jobs; the rise of animal rights and meat alternatives; and human beings with end-stage dementia in an era of limited health care resources. End of our time for this week on Religion in the News. We certainly do hope you've enjoyed the program, and thank you very much for tuning in. I'm Brian LeBlanc, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and our program is generously supported by White Memorial Presbyterian Church. They can be reached at 919-834-3424. As always, we thank them for their generosity. Don't forget that you can take Religion in the News with you as a podcast no matter where you are. Just visit our website at ncreadingservice.org, click on the Listen tab, and find Religion in the News in the listing of podcasts on the left side of the page. We hope you've appreciated this episode of Religion in the News, and we hope you'll tune in again next week. If you see a story you'd like to see featured, give us a call at 919-832-5138. We'll talk to you next time on Religion in the News.